Welcome to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast, where we discuss the world of IT and cybersecurity. Don't be left in the dark about what is going on in the world around you. Here is your host, Joe Gray.
Welcome to the next edition of the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Gray. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of mine or my guests' employers, past, present, or future. With that being said, this week, on very short notice, my guests are Joe Vest and James Tuberville. They work with Menace. They are the co-founders of Menace. Joe, his name may sound familiar because he was the technical editor of the Red Team Field Manual. He has a whole swath of SANS GX certifications, OSCP, and he was a technical lead for a Department of Defense Red Team. With James, he also has a swath of certifications. He's also a founder of Menace, and he also was a Red Team leader for the government. Welcome, gentlemen. How are you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm great, and once again, thanks for jumping on with short notice.
Oh, not a problem. Not a problem. It's good to be it's rare to have us available short notice, but it just worked out great. Sitting in a hotel, getting to talk to you.
Excellent. The stars have aligned.
Oh, yeah.
If there's a day to buy a lottery ticket, this might be the day.
Yep.
So with that being said, fill in any major blanks that I left in terms of the introduction. Tell us a little bit more about yourself, and then we'll talk a little bit about a pretty hot button topic right now in InfoSec.
Sure. So this is Joe. Been doing IT security for a long time. Went down the normal path of I was in IT, didn't even know security was a thing. Started seeing breaches in a company, and it exposed me that security was it's a path. And I decided at that point, oh gosh, this is in early 2000s that I wanted to do this thing I just learned about called pen testing, and I just dedicated myself since early 2000s to that. And eventually landed myself in the Red Team world and got to do a lot of fun stuff. And then both James and I, about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago now, started our own company. So we left our old work that we were working with and started a company named Menace, focusing on offensive security, red teaming, pen testing, threat emulation, and such. So that's the real quick, my background.
So it's James. Mine's pretty much the same, just a background system and network admin. Accidentally fell into the world of security and fell in love with it. And I've been here roughly 10 years now.
Excellent. And during that time, I'm sure it was a wild ride. I mean, during my 7-year career in InfoSec, I've definitely seen a lot of things change, a lot of significant disruptions in terms of market disruptors, not availability disruptions. I can imagine the things you've seen considering both of your backgrounds.
No, we've seen all kinds of crazy stuff out there, you know. I had to go break a bunch of stuff in the early days to realize most of the security problems were my fault as an IT sysadmin, and now I know better.
If only more sysadmins would go out and learn that. I think the relationship between system and network administrators and security professionals would be greatly enhanced, because a lot of times system administrators and network administrators are worried about administering their systems and networks, keeping the systems up and running smoothly. Security becomes an afterthought, and then you have some people that have basically just come up the ranks through security that don't understand the problems that system and network administrators face. And I think that would be a really good point for a learning opportunity.
You're absolutely correct, and we've actually talked this quite a bit. One of the benefits that we've seen, and some of the most successful people were those individuals, just as you said, that had a background in system and network administration and then worked their way up through to the security world. Not saying that's always the case, but I'd say in a good 90% of the time, you would see somebody that really knew system and network administration turn out to be really good in the security world. So because they actually understand the technology and how things actually work, and what those system and network administrators have to do and have to deal with on a daily basis. So they become really good in the security world.
Yeah, onto that, not to try to change or go down topics or another rabbit hole, but you always get the question, someone says, I want to get into security. It's one of the most popular questions I get across. And every time I always lean people to say, go learn the systems. You know, become a developer, go do sysadmin, network admin, learn the fundamentals, learn how technology works first. So you understand what it's supposed to do, how it's supposed to work. If, you know, as a red teamer, if I didn't understand how the systems work underneath, I have no idea how I would be successful at all.
Absolutely. And at the ISSA conference where we met there in Atlanta, when I was sitting at the SANS table, there were a few people that would come up and say, hey, I want to become a hacker. I want to become a pen tester. How do I do this? And I gave a very similar answer, but I also provided a little bit of a different perspective, because for me, I was a security person, then a system administrator, then back into security. And even as a system administrator, I was basically doing security. So I'm a little bit jaded with that. But basically, I told them that another route to go down, I did mention that system or network administration is definitely a good place to go. I told them Security Plus, Linux Plus, maybe even CCNA would be a good starting point if they wanted to go the certification route, and pointed them into the direction of some academic possibilities for that. But then I also mentioned that, you know, if you want to be a really good red teamer, it might not hurt to do some blue team activity, become a SOC analyst, and a junior incident responder, or just help desk, because a lot of people look past the whole help desk thing, but the reality of it is they are a vital role of incident response.
Oh, yeah. Bottom line I see is be passionate about technology and whatever area you're working in, and that's how you can improve. That's really what it is. You've got to be passionate, take an initiative to learn. If your job is a sysadmin, be the best you can. If you're a SOC analyst, be the best you can. And if you love it and you're passionate about it, it's not hard to break into security.
Oh, absolutely.
And you're also absolutely correct on the blue side. There's a huge benefit that I think some don't really understand. And there's a benefit to even bouncing back and forth between the red and the blue, because you're staying current on both sides, which means you're extremely proficient on both sides. And let's face it, the role of the red team, just like the role of the blue team, is ultimately to secure a specific organization or network. And the best way to do that is to bounce back and forth and make sure you're current on both sides.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've got this new phenomenon going on, the purple teaming, purple team engagements, and people viewing themselves as purple teamers, as well as threat hunting. You know, that's kind of a mix, if you will, of both worlds, really. Because I'll be honest, I kind of consider myself a little bit of a purple teamer, but I will say that I'm closer to the blue side than the red side right now. I have the competencies for some stuff on the red side, but I usually try to learn things a little bit redder in nature so that I can use them to better assist my clients in building their defenses. Because honestly, if I don't know what the current attack trends are, or I don't know what some of the methods are or the tools being used, how can I possibly tell someone how to secure their infrastructure?
Oh, yeah, exactly. I completely agree with that.
And then, you know, conversely, if I were, you know, in more of an offensive position right now, I would be relying on my experience as a blue teamer of, okay, well, here's some common mistakes I saw when I was a systems administrator. Here's some common problems that I've heard people talking about when they talk shop. Here are some things. So, you know, honestly, I think both fields really feed each other. And the problem that I see would be people completely discounting the relationship between the two and the ability for the two teams to learn from each other.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I've had some of the best experiences I have on the red side is, and it doesn't always get to happen. Sometimes you're in, you do a report, and you're out. But when you get to actually spend time, I usually call these tech-on-tech sessions, where you get the technical people on the red, on the blue, and go together in a room and figure out what happened. You lay all your cards on the table. Blue gets to see what happened. You get to all become on one team. And it is some of the most valuable learning lessons when red and blue actually work together, because both sides have a lot of assumptions about how the other operates. And those assumptions usually bite them.
We all know what are said about assumptions, right?
Yes.
So with that being said, let's go ahead and kind of transition into the current event topic, since we're not kind of going through the news. We'll hit a current event topic, and then we'll take our break, and then get into what Joe and James are here to talk about, and that is the difference between red teaming and penetration testing, as well as some war stories. So the current event that I chose for this episode is a thing called FamilyTreeNow.com. Long story short, it is a website. It's a genealogy website. It doesn't require payment or authentication, which that's what differentiates it from, say, Ancestry or Genealogy.com or any of those. And basically, it's just an OSINT playground. You can go in, you can search about anyone by name, location, middle name, date of birth, date of death, anything. Guys, what could possibly go wrong here?
Oh, man, that's just crazy. So, you know, doing OSINT on people for various tasks, you know, to try to target, the more personal you get against on someone, you know, you can pull at their heartstrings, you can tailor things closer to them. The more information you have about someone, the more successful you can in doing, you know, bad guy things to them.
So, you know, just take into account the bit of information that you have on that site. People typically do bad things because they're convenient. And you start talking about, just say, a password. You know, a password is relatively simple. But let's face it, most people use things like, you know, their alma mater, their children's name, their spouse's name, their pet's name, those types of things. And with something like FamilyTreeNow, we're looking at this amount of data, you're associating them with other people. You can actually take that and you can scope it through all the social sites and verify, you know, who and who is not a member of their family. You can look at some of their profiles, determine what their pet's names are. And for something even as simple as that, you can get a pretty quick and accurate guess, or at least a list of things that you could add as possible password that you could use against an account or whatever it may be. And be fairly accurate, I'd say 90% of the time. I mean, it's just the way most people are. They try to remember something that they love, they feel passionate about, and it turns into some form of a password. And that's a very simplified example, but you start chaining that out through gaining access by their birth dates, their birth years. You're eventually going to be able to get their birth dates. There are sites out there that you've got enough information you can string together and you could actually get their social security number. So there's lots of things that you can use all this freely open and available information for, into not only gaining access to, say, their personal information, but that could eventually get into their business aspects, their financials. There's a never-ending list of possibilities there.
Absolutely. And even if you can't get the password, you can find enough stuff to be able to reset their password, which in by some accounts is even worse. Additionally, you know, a lot of people take a lot of pride in, well, I'm not on social media. Well, you might not be, but your children may be, or your parents may be. Yeah. Using that website to find your associates, you can go and find out what Target X's daughter's name is, find her on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter where she overshares data. There's him in a bunch of pictures. Okay, oh, I recognize that in the background. Or, oh, here, let me scrape this picture so I can run some metadata on it. Ooh, that confirms that they are in this geographic region. And then it completely negates any safety measures you have, which there is an opportunity for you to opt out, but part of the analysis with the blog post that I've been working on deals with the terms and conditions and the privacy policy. Nowhere in the privacy policy or the terms of conditions does it say anything about deleting accounts. So I have a feeling that even if you opt out of the information, I have a feeling that your data will still remain there. It's just, it won't be quite the same. Apparently they didn't read up too much on what happened with Ashley Madison and not deleting accounts.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's you know, information wants to be free. You've heard that. And it's going to be. And it's frustrating because you have got to come up with other technical controls because your data is out there. And you know, so if your target, if you can go and just profile them, understand them, their friends, their family, their relationships, and there are no other controls against your target, maybe like a multi-factor or something like that, you know, you've got a lot of data. This type of information on, if I'm doing a red team engagement and I'm using phishing, you know, this is good OSINT for phishing, I typically I would say 80+% of all of the engagements I've done over the years have used less than 10 fishes. No more than 10 targets. Usually it's 3 or 4. And that's it. Highly targeted. Once I have my payload delivered or password or whatever my goal was, I'm done. And these types of things provide a lot of that good OSINT. So you do a lot of good recon. You do your OSINT. Do your homework. Figure out what you need. And highly targeted attacks just work, period.
Absolutely. And I'm going to unveil something here. By the time this goes live, I will have already presented it at work. And the blog post that goes along with it, with a company that I don't work for, should be live, or it should be about to go live. So I'll go ahead and unveil it. So I've been working on establishing a phishing campaign using Family Tree Now. And what I did was I purchased a domain that's very similar to it. I'm not going to get into too much detail about that aspect. But it's close enough to where if someone glances at it, they're going to be like, oh, okay, it's from Family Tree Now. And the campaign basically, which I'm doing it as a proof of concept, not an actual payload. So I'm not going to get very aggressive with it. But in doing it, I was able to clone the site. And from there, have it to where I could have some data fields for people to input information. And the reason the domain was important, not for the website, the domain was important for the email. The email that will come out will say, someone has posted information about you on familytreenow.com. Here's some of the information, which I would have already gathered via OSINT, about you. Please click here to confirm, or please click here to opt out. And at that point, in the actual attack, the opt-out button would be the payload. In the actual attack, I would be prompting that user for more information if they want to confirm it. So I would probably put something a little bit wrong and then just have several fields for them to fill out to see how much data I could get out of them.
That's really cool.
A nice level of brutality. It's just like any other phishing campaign, though, really. I mean, there's not a whole lot that's different, because really what it's doing is it's just looking good enough for someone to glance at and be gullible and say, oh, hey, this looks real. So, and that's what it is. And I think sites like this, when you go to a site and you're expecting to confirm this information, you already have it in your mind psychologically that you're ready to provide a lot of information anyway. That's one of those problematic aspects that really delve into the six principles of persuasion, right? So, and anytime you're doing social engineering or phishing, it all goes back to those six principles.
Yeah, and pulling on people, getting enticing people to do things is
absolutely
what makes phishing work. And yeah, it just works. Period.
Absolutely,
phishing just works. I have a whole topic on how phishing just works and how that affects red teaming and, or more like on blue teaming. On that side, I've actually quit blaming the users for phishing failures and blame the organization.
So the day that we're recording this, I actually had a blog post go live today with CISOcast, and it was how to build a social engineering awareness program from a cultural perspective. And it's a 5-part series. The first part just came out, and I talk about the burden shouldn't be on the user. The burden should be on the organization, because the organization has to have a culture where the users can report attempts, so that if a domain keeps sending these things, it could be the unsubscribe button could be the payload. So it would be better for the administrators just to block that domain and that IP address. But you've got to have that culture in place so that users feel comfortable enough to report. Because if you have a hostile environment, and, you know, if an employee clicks the fish, they get fired, they're never going to report it. Conversely, that's going to overcomplicate your incident response process, right? Because the devil you know is a lot better than the devil you don't know. And if you know where the proverbial patient zero is, it makes life a lot better.
Oh, yeah. I've kind of taken it, I don't know if it's different. In my mind, it's different, so it's different for me on phishing. So now I have just said phishing is going to be successful, period. So phishing can be successful, but exploitation, compromise of your network through a fish is 100% the fault of the defending organization. So if someone can get phished and click on a link and that owns your internal domain, that's not that person's fault for clicking the phish. You've got bad problems that allow someone to click a link and own your domain. That means anyone in your network can become the domain, own the domain inside. There's no difference. Phishing is just an enabler, potential enabler for someone to become an insider, you know, to have the same view. So,
absolutely. And this is a cliche term that I've begun to use, but people can spend $500, $50,000, $5 million, $5 trillion on technology, but if I can exploit a user, I've pretty much negated every bit of that. And that's why I'm a huge advocate for training your users, keeping them aware, let them be your first line of defense.
So we agree. User training is extremely beneficial. One of the aspects that we're taking, though, is we know there's going to be users that no matter what, no matter how much amount of training that you provide to that user, they're going to do bad things. They're going to do stupid things, not just because they're bad people, but because they just don't understand, right? And from that aspect, there are, you know, several things that we like to kind of promote on the red and the blue side that make it harder for a bad guy to move laterally throughout the network, to escalate privileges, those types of things. And that's really the things that we focus on whenever we go to these organizations. We say, train your users. Yes, that's the first line of defense. That's the first step. That's the, you know, biggest bang for your buck when you start talking about avoiding some of those successful phishing attempts. So what we also emphasize, though, is, as Joe said, phishing is going to be successful, right? If it's a targeted spearfish, they've got an appropriate amount of information, they know exactly how to target that specific user, what that specific user is interested in, and they know how to entice them to click the link, the document, whatever it may be, phishing will be successful in the end. So then what can that organization do, assuming that that user has been breached? What can that organization do to make it hard, as I said, to move laterally throughout the network, to escalate privileges, to gain information? And that's one of those secondary aspects where we go down now to help the organizations defend against the what we know is going to happen, the known bad, right? So it's a different take. It's actually being well received. Because I think a lot of organizations know they're training their users. That's great. It's extremely useful. It's extremely beneficial. But we all know we've had those users that just don't do what you want them to do. And they do exactly the opposite. And they just do crazy things because they're crazy people or whatever the
right
reason may be.
You have that one user every time. It doesn't matter. You could have completed phishing training with them 5 minutes beforehand. Send them the email. They're going to click it or die.
Exactly.
And
oh yeah,
they're my personal favorites during engagements, but it's hard to point out who it is.
Well, yes. Yeah. Finding that target's there, but we've come up with ways to do that. It's usually not terribly hard to figure out potentials, but like I said, I mean, in this case, if I only send 3 to 5 fishes or at least less than 10, and that's been successful the entire time I've been doing red teaming, there's some disconnect. I'm not saying that that doesn't mean user awareness.
Oh, absolutely.
But what's happening, a lot of organizations punt the ball over to the user awareness side and don't take responsibility to understand. I don't want to go too far into the whole red teaming side yet, but you know, the kill chain is extremely important. That's a really important piece. So a defender's ability to impact that kill chain is huge. And if someone can get a fish and that's the only defense they have, then they're wide open the rest of the way.
Absolutely. To kind of give a little bit of a taste of a little bit further down the line in this series of blog posts, part of what I heavily advocate is during the training, don't use some out-of-the-box training. I'm not saying don't use things like go fish or fish me or whatever. What I'm saying is whenever you're defining the response you want your people to take on when they receive a phishing email or a phishing call or some solicitation for information, you need to define down to the T with absolute certainty and precision what you want that user to do. Don't leave it up for them to guess. You say, if you receive a phishing email, I want you to either A, delete it, B, block sender. C, download the email as a, or forward it as an attachment, or save the email as a file and send it to me. You send it to this email account. You call this phone number. You go to this office. If you click a phish, here's what you do. You power your machine down. You disconnect the network cable. You don't touch anything. You walk away. You call me. You email. What do you want them to do? Don't put it up to them to guess, because they are not the security professionals. You are.
You're absolutely correct. I can't count the number of events that we've had where we perform some type of targeted phish, and because there weren't any type of response or reporting standards or processes in place, that user ended up forwarding it to a administrator, and then the administrator clicked the phish, which is what provided our administrative access. That has happened numerous times.
Absolutely. And you know, the other side that comes with this is, even if they click the phish and you're able to get some exploitation there, if they report it, that window is going to close a lot faster than if they don't report it at all.
Yeah, so I give there's a philosophy I have from red teaming is don't give blue a reason to look.
You know, absolutely.
That's one of your principles as a red teamer. And if people have a good phishing program, you might give someone a reason to look. And anytime blue looks, if they know what they're doing, they're going to find red. They're just going to find it, because a good blue team should always find them. But anyways, that's what I had to say. Don't give blue a reason to look. And if you've got a good defense program, which includes phishing, you know, that's just more, it makes it more difficult for the attacker.
And as you stated earlier, on the opposite side of that, outside, say, just the password in the phishing realm, there's an infinite number of possibilities with this type of, you know, OSINT, this type of data, simply from the aspect of, can you use it to answer reset questions? Can you use it to guess, you know, a litany of items that you can use to either reset a password or just flat out gain access to the account, or completely transfer account control over to another user, say yourself as the bad guy. So there's a infinite number of possibilities with this type of OSINT data, just outside the common everyday things that we like to think of, because they're easy to portray to others. But there are legitimately hundreds and hundreds of ways that data can be used to leverage the information for Red or for the bad guy.
Yeah. Absolutely. And
no, I was going to say, I don't want to jump into war stories, but this is a perfect topic on that side. So one of the last ones I did, phishing a campaign, worked as expected, macro delivered payload, so even kind of loud and obnoxious, getting to the point where you're watching the user, and the user is just there clicking, filling out the form that I sent them, and going back to look for jobs and look for vacations. I don't like to call it users in an engagement, but there you go. That's a perfect example of why they're going to be successful. You need to find that person. So in this case, it was an administrative assistant. So you're having someone who has high access to systems, but are considered low on the totem pole of the organization. But they have a lot of access because they're supporting multiple people and all the leadership. Great targets for a phishing campaign.
Absolutely. And that leads me to another soapbox that I've been getting on a lot lately, and that is defining position sensitivity and actually customizing training for the role. So in a general sense, you typically have general training that everyone takes. Privileged users typically have their own training that they take. My philosophy is that you should at a minimum have three levels of training. One of which for the layperson, one for the privileged users, and executives. Because oftentimes executives have more access than they need. It's not uncommon to see an executive with local admin, if not even worse. And then, you know, you start talking about other business units like human resources. They're expected to open Word documents that are sent to them because they may be resumes of their next rock star employee. Same thing with accounting and finance, contracting. They get those as well. Legal. I mean, you have all these entities that realistically they don't, just like an administrative assistant, they're not considered highly sensitive because, you know, they're low on the totem pole, but they're an excellent way to just absolutely get in. You know, send them a little special resume of sorts. Or my personal favorite right now, send all the employees some W-2s, because back to the six principles, people are greedy. And if you tell them that they can get their tax return sooner or there's going to be a delay in tax returns, they will download that W-2 and give you anything you want.
Yep. No, I agree. I got a whole philosophy on that on there as well, where on the red team side, sometimes what works can be risky. So sometimes you actually can't execute that in a test because, you know, if you're doing red teaming, pen testing, you're really not a bad guy. You know, you're really, I always say red is truly on the blues team at the end of the day. But sometimes you got to be careful on what you send to people because it might turn around and bite you.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. But, you know, in some cases, it may be that tipping point that influences the cultural shift that's necessary to have a successful organization as well, to actually have a good security program.
You are bringing one of the biggest points in red teaming right there, making those points. So when we get into the deltas on the pen testing and red teaming, I'll make a note of that and go down that route as well.
Excellent. So with that being said, let's go ahead and take our first break. And when we come back, we will jump into the conversation where we talk about the differences between red teaming and pen testing. Stay tuned.
Are you looking for a place to advertise to the unique audience of IT security professionals and enthusiasts? Look no further. Advanced Persistent Security is seeking sponsors. This slot could be yours. Contact sales at advancedpersistentsecurity.net for more information.
And we're back from our break. Thus far, I've had a discussion with Joe Vest and James Tuberville about social engineering, OSINT, familytreenow.com, and just some general information security topics and concerns. So at this point, we're going to talk about the differences between pen testing and red teaming. So at this point, I'm just going to turn the floor over to you guys.
Okay. This is Joe again. I guess I'll start off with this. Is it's a common question that comes up, what's the difference? And when you see someone actually execute some sort of test or engagement or event, whatever they call it, sometimes they have a few flavors of all of it, maybe from vulnerability scanning, pen testing, to red teaming. So I've been trying to come up, we've been working on ways to come up with how to describe this easy. Quick way, think of an inverse triangle where you have vulnerability assessments, pen testing, and red teaming. Pretty common way to see that, to where the vulnerability assessments are kind of narrow and wide, where your goal is to identify vulnerabilities across an organization, a system, whatever you're doing. That's the goal of what you're doing. You're looking at everything you can to find all the potential vulnerabilities, possibly against some standard. It could be the standard as simple as your vulnerability scanner, whatever it says is what you're doing. You jump to pen testing and you don't necessarily run a vulnerability assessment, but pen testing takes vulnerabilities where you discover it during the test or use prior vulnerabilities results, and now you're in that triangle in the middle, so you're narrower and deeper. So your real goal is to figure out exploitation paths. You know, how can I get from A to Z? What are possible? Most pen tests focus not just a single path, but you're looking at, okay, assuming, let's say, an external test. Let's find all the ways we can get in. Red teaming gets into a different way. The technology, the tools, the skills, very similar. We're all working in the offensive security space. Red teaming has it's goal-based. Red teaming focuses on scenarios and goals. You're looking at operational goals. We call these operational impacts. Basically, what makes an organization tick? What does it do? Organizations don't exist to be secure. So what can you do to make them not exist anymore? Where are their weak points? That's where red teaming focuses. You find scenarios and you exercise those scenarios. So it's at the bottom of that triangle to where it's very narrow but very deep. Example, I talked earlier about I may only send a few phishes. If I send 3 email phishes to an organization and I get my first initial connection and that's my launch point to continue through to my ultimate target, what does that tell me about phishing? Nothing. I sent 3 of, maybe you had 10,000 users, and I sent 3 emails and I got hooked in. It really tells you nothing. So you don't look at it from vulnerabilities. Vulnerabilities don't matter in red teaming. vulnerabilities and exploits are really a means to an end. The real goal is to try to get to the end to perform some sort of operational impact. Basically, let's, you know, if it's a, say a hospital, for example, they are really concerned because they get hit with heavy fines for losing personal data and PII and, or HIPAA-related data. They get fined quite a bit, so that's a huge impact to their organization. So you can look to see what is it, what an adversary can or a threat can do to impact that, steal that data, modify that data, to get in and do something negative to it. The exploitations, the vulnerabilities are all means to an end. They actually don't really matter so much as looking to see how an organization stands as a whole. Red teaming looks at the people, processes, and technology. So you look at everything as a whole.
So in a nutshell, when you get on that path, you say, okay, penetration testing is designed for that identification, isolation of those vulnerabilities, and then the exploitation to see if they can be leveraged to gain some type of access. Whereas on the red team side, that is automatically assumed. So we just assume going in that we're going to find vulnerabilities and we're going to be able to exploit those vulnerabilities. So as Joe said, given that scenario, what is the worst thing that could happen to this organization? What is the worst thing that could happen to that system? And there may be a series of those. There may be a top three or a top five scenarios that we run through as a red team to see if, first off, are they even possible? There's a lot of times where organizations are weighing these risks, but they're not even sure if these risks are viable. They've got these assumptions. They know what would damage them from the business aspect or from the organizational aspect, but they're not sure the validity or the actual capability of a threat to do certain types of actions. So that's one of the things. The other thing is for the red team to go in and perform these scenarios and these activities that cause these operational impacts, the goal of that entire structure is to first measure their security controls. Are their security controls effective? And at what point can those security controls be improved? Are their defensive controls and procedures effective? It isolates those, it forces those organizations to actually exercise their detection. It forces them to exercise their response procedures. It forces them to exercise their recovery restoration procedures. And a lot of those things don't actually occur during a penetration test because a penetration test is focused on, as he said, those vulnerabilities, those exploitation paths, whereas the red team is focused on those scenarios and those capabilities for the organization or system or network or whatever you're testing to exercise those controls, those defensive processes, a litany of things that they typically don't get to exercise. A lot of times we see incident response procedures, but they're never tested. They're never employed. They may go through some type of walkthrough or tabletop, but they're never actually tested and run through a scenario until a red team comes in and forces that to occur at the organization. There's a lot more that we can discover and a lot more that we have discovered in doing red teams that have already gone through, say, a typical vulnerability assessment and a typical penetration test because those types of scenarios were never forcibly tested. And once those defenders and those even system and network admins were forced to go through their procedures as they have documented or realized that, hey, some of these procedures we thought we had aren't complete, so they don't have an entirety or a full scope of what we should be doing, and they're forced to exercise that, they see a lot of their gaps and a lot of their shortcomings, not only in their procedures, but in their controls and their defensive posture as a whole.
Perfect. That definitely draws a lot of clarity to the topic. So would you say, as a gross overgeneralization, red teaming is ultra-focused pen testing on steroids?
Well, I wouldn't even call it pen testing. It's scenario-oriented testing. So bottom line with red teaming, you're measuring impacts against an organization. That's really what you're ultimately doing. I'll talk about red versus blue in a minute, but basically, if you're doing something, pen tests, for example, you get a lot of rules and handcuffs and what you can do. And there's good reasons for that because things can break and fears and such. But when you're doing a pen test, oftentimes, let's say you have a Windows network, getting domain is a huge goal. You know, that's a really important thing. But red teaming, that may not be, you may not need domain access. You may not need those administrative privileges. Or if you do, that might just be a means to an end. and has no impact on a final target. Good example, I was just recently working in a red versus blue challenge against the blue team. They had a specific goal to defend. They let the domain burn as the red team was operating because they were protecting their ultimate goal. And this is where red teaming comes in place. If you look at an organization or in the security community, we talk about you need to do better, and you're not doing this, or here's your recommendation. At the end of the day, an organization is going to do what they need to do to survive. And red teaming allows you to test that, preferably in a full live operational network. Dangerous? Maybe. If you have a good red team, not at all. But it does take a good experienced red team to understand how to generate operational impacts to stimulate an organization to test, you know, whatever your goals are. It's all goal-driven. But bottom line, everything's goal-driven.
Awesome. And that definitely makes a lot more sense because, you know, traditionally you always hear pen testers or even skiddies be like, oh, I'm a red teamer. But that's not what I'm hearing here, because a true red teamer is more. What I'm hearing is a red teamer could be a pen tester, but not necessarily the other way around.
It can be. I mean, it's going to be let's use an example. There's a common model that we'll use for red teaming. We'll call it the assume breach model. In other words, a lot of times people say, hey, hacker boy, I want to see if you can get in. So they'll stitch you on the outside. You're not allowed to fish. You can't do this. You're handcuffed. Do your pen test. You know, are you going to get in? Probably not. I mean, a hardened system with very little entry points, you're just not going to get in. People think, oh, you're going to hack the firewall and, you know, and do whatever crazy things you're doing. So what we're doing is we say, no, let's figure out, what is your goal? My goal is to protect my intellectual property. That is what makes my organization exist. Then you work backwards and you say, let's define a scenario. So maybe we say, I don't care how we're going to get in. We've had enough proof to show people can possibly get into your organization. They can physically walk in, social engineering, lots of ways. So using like an assume breach model, you go ahead and you do something we call white carding. Let's provide access to the red team. Some people don't like that. They said, you're cheating. Well, the goal is not to say, red teaming, you've got to do all your hacker things. No, the goal is to say, let's see, under this scenario, under these conditions, what an adversary can do. Now, this also means the red team must use real TTPs, or tactics, techniques, and procedures. They basically have to have good tradecraft. They have to act like an adversary that they're trying to emulate, and move towards that goal in a realistic way. Along the way, they're going to manipulate and change their indicators of compromise, basically manage those to hide and or stimulate the defense. So you can test. You can say, hey, we want to make sure that if someone gets a phishing payload in our network, do we have capabilities of detecting this malicious Excel document? You know, what happens? Does it prevent it? And unless you test that scenario, you don't know. So you can actually test end goals and then all the paths to that end goal. And a lot of people in pen testing will do these things. I'm not going to say they don't. But somewhere you got to draw a line and try to have a difference. And this goal-oriented piece where you're doing operational impacts, controlling your indicators of compromise so that you can emulate a threat in a specific way for a specific scenario is where red teaming comes in.
And another benefit there is, you know, a lot of the times as a red teamer, you are requested and required to make your way into a network. That's just kind of the way it is. That's what people expect. And sometimes you're not. So whenever you start talking about the goal, if testing the, say, perimeter and the detective defenses at the perimeter or threat coming in is part of that goal, is part of that goal path in that scenario, then it's viable for testing, and that makes perfect sense. In that case, there would be some type of overlap with maybe the penetration test of a boundary, obviously. And that same organization, maybe they've already been through a boundary penetration test, and whether or not it's true or not, they feel confident that they are protected at the boundary. And what they really want to know is, hey, can they get to my human resources records, or can they get to my financial data? Because we are a financial organization, and that's what we protect. We manage and we maintain money. So can people get to that? And the whole scenario isn't about can they get in, because the expectation for a lot of those organizations are, we know people will eventually get in. So how do we go about protecting our critical asset, which is the systems and networks that they use to maintain and secure their money and their transaction records? And from that aspect, you can say, okay, either we've got to fight our way in, depending on that scenario, or we already taking that assumed breach model. We're starting at a customer location or a partner location or even a remote location and seeing if we can access those financial records. And if we can access those financial records and those transactional records, what can we do with that? Could we reverse transactions? Can we make transactions? Can we zero out things? And that's just a broad example, but it's an example where you say that's the worst case scenario for one of those, say, financial institutions. And there's a lot of times simply because of the method of going down a Pinterest where they're testing access, they're testing exploit capability, and in the end, they're not coordinating and scheduling that scenario where the financial institution could actually see how quick would they actually detect a threat making those transactions. How quickly could they recover from that? How quickly could they restore funds, restore data? What if something was, just say backups and everything's removed, systems wiped, whatever it may be? Do they have backups far enough back to restore that data without causing some type of interrupt in the financial transactions? Because there is a period of time where there would be, it's not acceptable to restore, just say, data from 2 months ago, right? Especially in the financial world, it's just not acceptable. And then they have to go through those scenarios where, well, how do they validate their backups? Because we don't know when the threat was actually in. So there's a litany of scenarios and objectives during a red team test that aren't typically tested in, say, a pen test engagement, or obviously not in those vulnerability assessments. And it just helps those organizations better define what they are truly capable of seeing, what they are truly capable of responding to, and in that same aspect, what they are truly capable of maintaining as far as their business continuity and, I guess, being hot and providing the services to the customers that they're supposed to be providing services to.
Awesome. So this leads me to a question. And we hear the discussion quite frequently that an organization is not mature enough for a pen test. Would you say it's safe to say that an organization that's mature enough for a pen test may not be necessarily mature enough for a red team engagement?
It can't. Yes, that is definitely true. Maturity is there, but one thing that's really neat about a red teaming engagement versus pen test. Pen test is a lot of people have assumptions and they just kind of throw it into here, give me a pile of vulnerabilities that I can go fix. They kind of lump them with vulnerability assessments, even if it's not. Red teaming, though, even if you just walk through the process with a less mature organization, there's a tremendous amount of learning and education on that part. I didn't talk about this. Another huge piece of red teaming is one of their main goals is not only delivering operational impacts to stimulate an organization to test people, processes, and technology, but it's to train the blue team. Raphael Mudge did a really good talk a while back on hacking to get caught. And that's one of the roles of a red team. That's what you're trying to do. You are trying to emulate or stimulate or to portray some sort of scenario, a threat, so that you can practice with your blue team. If your blue team is going to get practice, they can have practice from a capable adversary or from the real bad guys. And that knowledge is even helpful on the immature people. Now, you may not actually do the red team engagement on the less mature organizations, but even the dialogue and trying to keep these things separate is good. I really like the red team approach. Even if I do pen tests, I still use red teaming approach. It's a habit of mine, but mainly for the educational piece of the target organization. Even if I do a traditional pen test, I have my reports and my terms and my final briefings with these organizations in red team context goals, because I know that's what they care about. You got to put it in their terms.
And just to be clear, he's talking blue teams. When we talk blue teams, we talk the entire defense of the organization. So that may be a specific defensive LNet or a CND, but it also includes your system administrators or network administrators. If it requires help desk personnel, it's that entire grouping, everything that contributes to the defense of the organization is part of their blue team. So,
Awesome. So this is something that you're going to just to correlate it to the disaster recovery world. This is basically the equivalent of a full interruption test.
Yes.
If it's scoped in that manner. So obviously, with those scenarios and with the objectives and goals, if it's a full scope, full impact assessment, and that's the way it's been scoped, then absolutely yes. But as stated earlier, there are going to be those situations and those scenarios where they have a specific system or capability that they want to impact, and maybe two of their other capabilities are out of scope. So it really is completely dependent upon the scenario and the goals that are pre-coordinated with the customer.
Awesome. So it's not so much, you know, I don't want to cast too much shade upon pen testing, but a lot of times they will scope it to a point to where your senior security management can walk around with their chest puffed out.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So red teaming, if you plan it right, you put those out there and you design the scenarios. And to be honest, if you're a good red teaming organization that wants to do this, you just don't engage that. And you say, and you call it what it is. You know, it's good in the security community that we try to call things what they really are. It helps us all to keep things in those lanes, not because you shouldn't play in those lanes, but it helps with the clients and customers to get what they're going. I consider vulnerability assessments and some, but not all, pen tests to be good hygiene. Those are the things you should do. So when you're going in as a red team, you assume that they are on top of everything they can do. It's kind of a starting assumption point that you do when you're going after an organization. But you know, it's the final exam of what you're doing. You're looking to see what can a bad guy do. I mean, go pick up any report that shows company X was attacked and all these bad things happened. Well, they got red teamed. But not without without a report and with no education on that. And if you look at anybody doing anything, you've got to practice. You have to practice. I mean, I'll give you a war story. There was one, a great one. Get in an organization, get in, establish ourselves. You can call it, we're doing pen testy type stuff. You're moving around, doing stuff. I own the domain, all these things. Eventually you say, hey, now we have to stimulate. In this case, the goals were to stimulate an organization to react. It was basically how much volume, where can you get these guys to react? Well, ultimately, a serious reaction happened, basically announced ourselves, and this tested their IR very well in the sense that their sysadmins, once they realize systems were compromised, pop-ups were on the desktop, the operational impact was a bit silly, basically pop-up messages and play some audio. But the silliness wasn't important. It was, we needed to stimulate this. The organization literally ripped cables out of the wall and out of all their equipment and disconnected themselves. Did a self-denial of service for almost a day. But they wouldn't have known that. You know, fortunately, we weren't a real bad guy. They were actually able to go through this. After a little bit of heartache, they all learned quite a bit about what does and does not work. So all of their paper drills got put to the test.
And in that same scenario, given their incident response, they actually had a pretty solid incident response plan. But when it came down to their actual response, what actually happened in real world, nobody even gave a thought to their IR plan and just started reacting based off of their gut feeling. And it was a great, as he said, a great learning objective in that instance for the organization, because they realized they had not adequately tested any of their procedures. So,
perfect. I've always heard that unless you have the other 19 critical security controls, just to tie this in with SANS, seeing as this you're working on a red team course for SANS, a lot of people say unless you have the other 19 critical security controls implemented, you shouldn't do pen testing. What I'm hearing from you guys would be, unless you have all 20 critical security controls implemented, you are probably not tall enough to ride the red teaming ride.
That's debatable. So it's not. It's a fair semi, blanket statement. But like I said, there's many times that red team conversation can help drive. Even maybe someone realizes, wow, I really need to step up my vulnerability assessment program so that I can do better penetration testing. So having this end goal, because like I said, if we in the security community keep things in line with vulnerabilities, basically I'm looking at the compliance world, which drives a lot of what we have, which we need to use more as a weapon to gain funding to make things better. That's a different topic though. But as long as we're driving those things and having vulnerabilities and exploitation, the driving point, we miss why an organization needs to protect its goods in the first place. They don't know, and who cares about a vulnerability? I mean, who cares about an exploit? If those have no impact or they are tolerable, and it sounds crazy to say, to the defense of the organization's core piece, then they don't matter, or at least they don't matter to the organization. We in the security community may say, hey, this is really important, but they don't care. They say, hey, it doesn't hurt my bottom line. We're going to move forward. So that's one thing that Red Team really helps change and work in their terms, in their where their touch points are to help them understand how to apply security better.
Awesome. And to start winding this segment down, what advice would you give someone who is an aspiring Red Teamer in terms of logical steps and things to do to become a better candidate for red teaming?
That's tough. So red teaming covers a lot of things. We'll talk about, I guess, the digital, the cyber side of things. I won't go into the physical side right now, but you know, sitting behind a keyboard doing that stuff. It's very similar to what you need to know if you are a sysadmin or a pen tester. Same kind of things. The best thing advice I have is find a mentor or someone you can work with who has been doing this and can help you build that mindset. I've worked with a lot of people who are really, really good technical people, but their mindset of understanding how to manipulate and really put that good bad guy hat on to know how to move through things and get out of the exploitation piece. Like, I don't need exploits all the time. I don't need these 0 days. I don't need all that. Always. Sometimes they help. I'm not going to say they don't. But to shift your mindset to learn how to bend and manipulate a system to achieve an operational impact, a goal, you know, steal that data or whatever, and be much more targeted. So a mentor and basic your normal security skills, pen testing skills.
So I would also say communication, being able to portray the information you're trying to provide and tailor that to your specific audience is extremely, extremely beneficial on the red teaming side. Because of a red teamer and because of what you do, you're going to end up interfacing with multiple groups. You're going to be interfacing with the executive levels. You're going to be interfacing with the technical levels. And at some point, you're going to be interfacing with the user levels. So being able to tailor your communications to the group that you're actually addressing, that's probably more valuable than anything else. If you start talking technical or even a bit technical with a user, their eyes glaze over, it goes right over their head. You just lost all concentration, you know, everything with them. The same thing with the executive group. So being able to tailor that to either way is extremely useful. And it's at the same time, focus on those user interests and those user requirements with the user group. Focus on those business and those business impacts with the executive level, and then the technical aspects, and tie in that business aspect at the technical level. And if you focus on those communication skills and actually know what you're doing, you understand the technology that you're talking about, you're a grade A red teamer.
So it's more than just poning all the things. You should probably know some interpersonal communication, perhaps a little psychology, some technical writing, and maybe some public speaking. Is that what you're saying here?
Yes. Communication is huge. Yeah, and owning everything is fun. I'm not going to say it's not. That is some of the most fun you can do. But that is I always tell people who are red teaming, if you want your red teaming glory, the guy sitting next to you is who's going to be excited for you. No one else is going to care about what kind of little tricks and stuff you did. That's it. The organization doesn't care. They're looking for how does this impact us and go forward. And take your little if you're a highly technical person, enjoy that personally. Share it with your people right around you, your peers. But communicate at the business level with those impacts, what's important to them. Stick with the goals, and you'll do fine.
And another useful thing, and he was just saying the technical aspect is only part of it, and gaining, you know, administrator privileges is only part of it. So if you've got that mindset where you can say, how would I affect this system, this network, this business, this organization without having user level or even, you know, administrative level privileges? And you can start walking through that. Once you did get user level privileges or admin level or domain admin, you roll right into that. So getting that mindset of how you can affect things at all levels, no matter what type of access or where you are in the network, is extremely beneficial as well.
Excellent. And on that note, we're going to take our next break. And when we come back, we're going to swap some war stories. So stay tuned.
Are you subscribed to this podcast? If not, please do so on iTunes and at advancedpersistentsecurity.net/podcast.
Attention listeners, have you ever been interested in recording a podcast of your own, whether it be information security, technology, cooking, or even flags? Look no further. Zencastr is here. Zencastr is a cloud-based online solution that provides each guest with a separate track. WAV files, built-in voiceover IP, cloud drive integration, automatic post-production, and a soundboard for live editing. If you are interested, go to zencastr.com, ZENCASTR.com, and enter coupon code APSPODCAST20 for a 20% discount. Once again, that is Zencastr, ZENCASTR.com. I hope to listen to you soon. And we're back from our break. So at this point, we've talked about FamilyTreeNow.com. We've talked about phishing and social engineering. We've done a comparison between penetration testing and red teaming. So at this point, gentlemen, share with us some war stories.
So we'll initially allude to the one that we just kind of discussed in generality. We had this one event, and it turned out to be a really interesting event simply because we had multiple objectives in the course of this red team. We had two objectives for external access. We had a objective for connecting two supposedly isolated networks on the inside of their domain. And then we had an objective of causing the operational impacts. So in the first objective, we ended up gaining access pretty quickly from the outside, from the internet, gaining access to their domain. So we had to step back, and no, that was the technical piece. So we had to step back, and at the request of their CIO, we actually executed a phishing campaign, and that was successful as well. So we went through this process of picking and choosing whether we went down the technical route or the phishing route for demonstrating the objectives as we move forward. And again, at the request of the CIO, we did it through the phishing campaign, and we just kept the external technical access on the back burner in case we needed it later. Because sometimes in the red, you are caught or discovered prematurely, and you need that backup. So we kept that in reserve, and we went down the phishing route for demonstrating access. And what we quickly discovered was they had a sensitive area where they kept their intellectual property that was supposed to be on a isolated network segment from the rest of their network. And we quickly discovered that they were not truly isolated, and their test development network, where they did all their QC, was pretty much open, and we were able to access that and use that QC network to pivot into both their production and their intellectual property network. So we were able to bridge that gap. And then the remaining goal or the remaining objective was to start causing these impacts and determine what their threshold was for detecting a threat and then responding to a threat. So typically on the red team side, you go in low and slow. Your objective is not to get caught. And then you start ratcheting up your activities and your indicators of compromise. And you kind of determine what that threshold for the defensive side to detect you and then how they respond. And you kind of go through those processes, and you're going back and forth between what you're doing and trying to watch and determine what Blue is doing so you can compare those notes in the end. Well, as we started ratcheting up our presence on the network, we quickly determined that it was going to take quite a bit to for them to even detect us. They had lots of tools, lots of systems, and lots of things out there on their network that were supposed to be able to detect this, but it just wasn't working. In the end case, once we started ramping up, we started throwing out ICAR and, you know, everything that we could think of that would just blatantly provide them alerts. In the end, we had to display a image, and we played an audio byte across every domain-connected system in their network. So, of course, you have – we tried to time it where it was simultaneously, but, you know, as network – things occur, you know, you'd have one pop off now, one pop off 3 seconds for now. But in the end, we had all of their network systems showing this image and playing the soundbite at max volume. And what that resulted in was the system and network administrators, because they had not detected anything previously, it was just a what seemingly to them was a outright blatant attack against their organization and network. And keep in mind, they were completely unaware. The only person that knew about this test in its entirety was the CIO. So once we executed that impact, absolutely benign, didn't actually cause any real network outage, didn't actually cause any impact to their production or operational status. It was a operational impact because it caused them to stop and do something else other than what they're used to doing. And because they were caught unaware, completely off guard, they basically panicked. And in that panic state, they did not consider their incident response procedures. They, in fact, all of their procedures just went out the window, and they started reacting without thinking. And that's that instance where they actually went and started pulling cables out of their racks. They started pulling cables from workstations once they realized that a reboot didn't stop it. They even went over their emergency alert system. You know, large organizations, a lot of times they have a way to make announcements in their buildings, things like that. They went over their emergency alert system and told everyone to stop using any of their workstations, which caused every user they had to basically end production for the day. And that lasted for several hours, because once they removed their cables, they also didn't follow their procedures for recovering and restoring, which meant they were just booting things randomly. They were trying to figure out what was going on. They didn't properly boot their domain controllers before they start booting their exchange. There's just tons of things that they were doing out of this reactionary cause. And they basically lost a day. I think it was 6 hours total that they lost of time. So not only did they lose their production time, but they lost the production of the individuals, any local work that could have been done throughout the entire organization was just lost. So you're talking about paying time for people. You're talking about loss of production. You're talking about system downtime. You're talking about time for restoring and recovering from actions that they inflicted themselves, and it was all because they had never exercised any of their processes or procedures. And our first perception as a red team is, wow, that was completely unexpected. Although we went through every check and balance we possibly could, we went and verified all of their procedures and made sure, based off of what we were doing, they had the capability and the procedural processes to recover, restore, all those types of things. We could have never perceived or, I guess, guessed their reaction. And neither could their CIO. And the other thing that resulted in that was they started performing these actions and reacting to a perceived threat in their network without ever communicating the issue up the chain. So the CIO, although he knew based off of working through the red team that the action was occurring, he never received notification or word from his own organization. And that also showed a issue with their communication process, because obviously if an entire business goes down, they lose all production and everyone is off system. Their management, their especially their CIO, should know. And he wasn't made aware of that for several hours. And it was extremely eye-opening to everyone and every level within that organization.
I bet the lessons learned section of that incident response package was pretty interesting.
Well, you know what? Actually, so because we had leadership buy-in, And that's another critical thing. It's actually with any tests, but especially red teaming, because you can see the impact. The leadership was ready and willing to experience the bad. That wasn't necessarily planned, because you don't really know how things are going to react, but that's why you test. That's why you want to make sure you understand how people, processes, and technology as a whole react and defend. Like James said, early on, some of the less important but still goals were, you know, we're measuring the ability for them to detect and see if they can detect any of our C2, our command and control channels. Are they able to see us moving laterally through their network? So a lot of those are kind of normal pen test type things, but really all of those were set up as a means to an end. And we had to go all the way to the end in this case because the means were not stimulating them enough. Now, purposely, we were using more stealth tactics to try to go under the radar so that we can position ourselves to do this impact. But ultimately, the impact, to understand how the organization responds to a bad guy. And you get to see it. But they were happy. There's a lot of hurt feelings for a while and people saying some bad words, but eventually it was like, okay, we're glad we went to that. It wasn't a real bad guy thing. They could breathe easier.
And the second benefit is when you actually go in and immediately following an event like that, especially system and network administrators, the defensive teams, they're going to be on the defensive. That's just the way the world works. Going in and doing those executive briefings and those tech-on-tech briefings and not specifically identifying their faults immediately and basically working through, this is what we saw and this is what we would recommend as a cursory, that initial brief, not the final report, but just that initial brief, trying to ease that tension and saying, this is what we would have recommended to happen, and turn that into a learning lesson for them. It was, again, people were a little bit defensive, but as they get into that, oh, we're actually learning things. We're actually learning how to make ourselves better. You ease into that tech on tech, and people end up very much enjoying the entire process. And in the end, I think everyone that we've talked to, even since, they count that as one of their biggest, learning opportunities of their career when something like that happens. Because unless a organization, like Joe said, is willing to accept the bad, there's lots of times where those types of things are never exercised.
Absolutely. And you said you played a soundbite. Out of curiosity, please tell me it was a Rickroll.
No. So
it was a Thunderstruck. So
yeah.
Okay.
So I made some fancy ASCII art for a pop up, and because you need ASCII art, and we had some Thunderstruck going. So it was sometimes in red teaming, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with this, but I will use the Hollywood hacking piece, and you use this sparingly, not to show off how cool you are as some hacker, because that's not important in red teaming, but you're using it to demonstrate a purpose. So in this case, we realized this organization was having a hard time getting it. So it may sound silly, but seeing what people do on TV, because that's what bad guys do, if you use that as a stimulus, it will stimulate them to go, oh, this really is a bad guy because I saw it on TV, or whether they acknowledge it or not, you know, this is what they're thinking because they've never faced a real threat. Doing things like that can be used if, as the red team, you don't go in and make fun of them and talk bad about them, but you use it as a learning experience. It was just a trigger to see what we can, what kind of response we can get.
Absolutely. And, you know, Thunderstruck, that's actually kind of ironic you picked that because, I recall correctly, it was used in the Ashley Madison data breach as well.
It was used in other places too. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because I remember.
Yeah, we didn't do that. That wasn't us in the Ashley Madison.
You were not the impact team?
We are not the impact.
And I checked my name. They must have deleted it quick enough, so my name wasn't in that list either.
Okay. Yeah, because I remember I gave a talk at Georgia Gwinnett College basically talking about the Ashley Madison data breach, and they asked if there was any special requirements I had for, you know, walking up on the stage. I was like, well, considering that Thunderstruck was played, and that's how they were notified, let's just do that. Did a few seconds of Thunderstruck as I walked up to educate some college students, getting some extra credit. and listening to Ashley Madison Data Breach conversation with a little bit. Yeah. So that's a pretty interesting scenario, because it really reminds me of my days back in the Navy, because when I was in the Navy, I was on submarines. And if you're not actively on mission and you're on a submarine and you're at sea, there's a good chance you're doing drills. They're sounding the general alarm. They're sounding the reactor casualty alarm, the collision alarm, whatever. They're sounding some alarm and you're running drills repetitively to the point to where they can see exactly what your actions are going to be, because sometimes they announce that they're going to be running drills in the afternoon. Sometimes it just happens. Because, you know, very similar to the incident response perspective, when basically the blue team, when you're running the red team adversary type engagement, you don't know when it's going to happen, and the easiest way to test how it's going to work is to actually do it.
Yeah, red teaming has been going on for a long time in the military community. You know, a lot of it is the physical, people kicking doors down, doing bad guy stuff like that. Same mindset, same ideas are used, but with the computer.
Mm-hmm. When I was in the Navy, the biggest thing that we dealt with was drills, which would basically be someone that's not attached to the submarine come and try to gain access to the submarine using a fake military ID that typically said Donald Duck or Mickey Mouse or something completely off the wall, just to see if they could get by the sentries and walk down and talk to the duty officer or captain, depending on what day of the week it is. You didn't want to be that guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
So I got to throw one more thing out and
sure.
Goes along with the war stories. In short, we had this event and we identified one war story that was great from the red teaming as well as the blue perspective. I want to throw up a quick example where it was not. And that was where we did an event and we accessed this organization from outside their boundary. And the objective was to get in their boundary, just kind of see what we could see and see what we could do. There wasn't any direct operational impact in this.
Well, yeah, the goals were to measure the abilities for the organization to detect C2, detect lateral movement, basically the various legs in the kill chain, you know. So kind of like how can a threat establish themselves as here to do bad things? That was more or less the scenario.
Right. At the end of this... So there were several interesting things identified, several interesting things discovered. But at the end of the event, all the technical group was really interested in was if they should have one or two firewalls. And no amount of discussion and training that we were trying to provide to this technical group, it wasn't being received. And to this day, their entire goal, their entire thought process and focus was whether or not they needed one or two firewalls at the boundary of their network. And it was, as a red team, even a pen test, even a vulnerability guy, it's very disheartening when you get into those situations where you do good, interesting things, you come up with good, interesting findings, and the customers kind of disregard it. Because they have this sole focus in mind. And that's just one of those things that need to be, you know, put out there as well. So red teaming is fun. Red teaming is very interesting, and you do really good things. But sometimes the result on the red team side is not as rewarding as you would expect it to be, simply because what you find interesting, the things that you see that can improve the security posture of that organization, that customer, that business, it just isn't perceived, and that's not their focus, and they totally disregard findings for the focus of what they're looking at.
Yeah. As a red teamer, you learn to disregard that and just say, you know what, I'll move on. You fought your fight and let the organization do what they want. So, yeah, that actually caught us off guard quite a bit because this was a lower level red team type of engagement, if you'd call it that. And lots of bad potential was there. It was almost like if you did like the first third to three quarters of like a full scale engagement, and where you kind of knock on the door of about to do these things, and that was the length of time. It was just a shorter engagement. And asking multiple firewalls. And you want to talk about being caught off guard as a red team, because you're like, you never anticipated that question. It kind of messes you up.
And honestly, this sounds like a place that would probably be heavily driven by compliance opposed to, say, security or privacy. Assuming that whatever compliance scheme they're under has a continuity of operations, contingency planning, BCP or DRP, did that not ever occur to them that redundant devices are pretty much a requirement in all regulatory compliance?
This is a case of, I don't want to say poor planning, that might be the wrong term, but basically misunderstanding on both the Red and the defenders. So the actual goal, which was discovered towards the end, was this was a budgeting meeting to discuss because somebody, compliance side, said you need to have two firewalls. I believe really what they were looking at is a various combination of some boundary defenses and isolate different networks, which might have made sense, but it was interpreted as I need two firewalls. And so from a Red side, it's really important to clearly state those goals up front so that you're always reiterating that. That's what makes red teams red teaming, is you have certain goals that you're trying to do. You are emulating a threat. You're stimulating the blue in some way. You know, you're trying to steal data or doing all of them. But those goals, so that they can be measured, so you can actually, you know, have some measurable impacts. Now, you may not measure them. The Red may not be able to measure them until they provide the results to the blue, who can actually decide if they figured this out. You know, maybe it was to say, can you detect them? And you do a two-week Red engagement. Well, blue detects them, but it took them a month to go figure it out. You know, there's still valuable information, but you don't decide it there. But the main thing is to have these measurable goals. And in this particular case, that was kind of missed.
And honestly, you know, that just sounds like a tremendous communication breakdown. Pretty much improper scoping. And to me, it kind of sounds like we always hear the euphemism of, you know, you've got two CIOs or CEOs on the golf course, and one says to the other, "What have you done recently?" "Oh, I got a security guy." "Oh, that sounds cool. I'll get one too." And then they hire somebody, but they don't know what they want to do.
So that's basically what happened in that instance is, you know, the management scoped and coordinated the test, and the technical group had a different objective than what their management had. And that was a issue that they had all along, but because Red was coordinating with management, obviously they didn't know until the end. And then even after the presentation of these interesting findings, these interesting observations, the end result wasn't, hey, we need to address these. It was, well, that doesn't answer my question whether we need one or two firewalls. And as I said, when you start talking about doing good things and you start talking about making a positive improvement on the security of a business, it's disheartening sometimes. And that people have to be prepared for that. And that doesn't mean just red team. That means across the board. Anyone trying to get into security has to be prepared for those types of situations. So,
you're saying if you get into security, be prepared for disappointment?
Yes, absolutely.
I would tend to agree with that statement. And, you know, honestly, that kind of reminds me of a story I just heard recently. Someone was doing a scoping phone call with a potential client, and basically the client wanted to know every single command that the vulnerability scanner was going to run against those hosts.
Yep, we've run into that numerous times. Goes to a maturity level. And I will say, it's important for it's not always easy, but if you have the option of saying thank you but no thank you and walking away, do it. Because you're not really doing anyone service. Because, I mean, you know, stick to your guns on what types of tests and what you're trying to do. And whether you call it a pen test, vulnerability test, red teaming, you know, that's fine. But as long as you've got a good, solid, defined scope of what you're really doing, that's what's important. And be prepared to walk away from those crazy things. I know that's not always a choice.
So that's one thing that we try to push on our side is we understand the need for billable time. And every business in the world is run like that. A business is run for the most part to either make money or be able to pay their employees, right? But in the end, to be a successful business, a long-term successful business, especially in the security community, you've got to provide a benefit. And If you're executing actions just to execute actions and the benefits are low, you're either going to end up damaging your reputation, or even if you're not, your employees are on the security side are not as happy because they want to do interesting things. And let's face it, most people are in security to do good things and have a positive impact. So the benefit there, Joe, is 100% correct, is provide that benefit. And if you're in that situation where you can't provide a benefit, it may be better just to acknowledge the issue and recommend the customer a different organization or a organization that is tailored for what they're specifically wanting.
Absolutely, and that does wonders for your reputation. You know, I've heard stories of people doing, I'm not going to say scoping, but having conversation with clients, and the client saying, hey, I want a pen test, and basically the client being told, you know, a pen test is a good thing, but honestly, you need to accomplish these objectives first to truly get any value out of the pen test. And I think in situations like that, that's a good example of the person that's telling them that, looking out for their well-being, their interests, while also continuing to add value to that organization.
Absolutely. Yep.
Awesome. With that being said, we'll go ahead and wind down on this segment. We're going to take our final break, and when we come back, we will say goodbye.
Don't forget to check out our blog at advancedpersistentsecurity.net/blog. Follow us on Twitter at @ADVPersistentSEC, and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/advancedpersistentsecurity.
And we're back from the final break. We've talked about war stories. We've talked about the differences between red teaming and pen testing. We've talked about social engineering and just general best practices. Unfortunately, we're out of time, and Joe and James are in a town that has pretty flaky electricity. They might be in Vermont. You never know. The Russians might be in the power grid. But with that being said, they've lost power, so we've got to get this recorded quickly. So with that being said, each of you provide a shameless plug for you, specifically your course, your business. Tell people how to contact you if you want to be contacted. And then finally, provide a piece of advice for up-and-coming information security professionals.
Yeah, sure. So one thing that James and I, we disappeared for the last 3 months over basically the holidays, and we've been working with SANS. I'm actually on the path to become a SANS instructor right now. But we are now some new SANS course authors with the SEC 564 Red Team Operations and Threat Emulation course. Really excited about that. Basically, it's a red team operations focused course. So it's technical. It does cover all these things. But what it does that I see that I have not seen a lot of other courses, if any, do is focus on red team operations, how red team operates, what they do, what they are, basically the mindset and how to build and create and operate within a red team. So basically this entire podcast that we've been talking about, these types of ideas and concepts, that's what this course focuses on. So I'm very excited. Right now I'm going through some review processes. If everything goes well, within the next 1, maybe 2 weeks, this will be announced on the SANS website.
Awesome.
In that aspect, we both, as you've stated a couple of times now, Minis, MINIS.io. You can contact us either James at Minis or Joe at Minis.io. We do red teaming. That's what we specialize in. But at the same time, we do some penetration testing, and we also do some security consulting. So if there's ever a need, then feel free to look us up and at least ask how we can help. And if we can't, we'll point you to somebody that can.
Excellent. And are you either of you active on, say, Twitter?
Medium. I will follow and go down that route. I should probably do it more than I am. But yeah, I will go down the Twitter route. So you can find me at Joe Vest.
Excellent. Okay. So this is the final piece for you. Provide a piece of advice for up-and-coming security professionals, and then a little bit for a seasoned professional.
Up-and-coming security, system and network administration, even if you didn't start there, there's a huge benefit to learning and understanding technology, how networks work, how systems work, and understanding what causes them to both fail and recover. There's a huge benefit.
Yeah, and one note on that, passion about what you do. You got to love it. It doesn't matter really what you do, but that for anyone new, just love technology and want to dig and spend hours doing this. For someone seasoned doing this, I would say one thing, don't be disheartened if you're in an organization or an environment that doesn't really work for you. There are plenty of opportunities and positions out there where you can find great peers. One of the best thing I've had is to find and work with some of the most amazing people out there. Finding great people is awesome. I always say don't be the smartest person in your room or in the group. You need to work with some really crazy smart people. It's amazing what you guys can learn when you're with a strong team.
Absolutely. You can't teach enthusiasm. I've said it before. If someone has the enthusiasm, the drive, and the determination to excel, succeed, and learn security, I am more than willing to teach that. The one thing I can't teach is the enthusiasm piece.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so this has been a great episode. It's been a lot of fun. I don't want to keep you too long. Do you have any parting words of wisdom before we say goodbye?
Have fun out there, and just stay passionate in technology.
Enjoy everything you do. So.
Absolutely. I say I've not worked a day since 2010. With that being said, you can contact me on Twitter at C_3PJoe, the podcast at @ADVPersistSec, the website advancedpersistentsecurity.net. We have a Slack channel. Shoot us a message on Twitter or tweet us if you want access to the Slack channel. With that being said, there's a lot of exciting things coming up with Tracy Mayleaf, who's just recently joined the Advanced Persistent Security Network, and another thing that's quietly creeping upon us that I'm not quite ready to mention yet. With that being said, though, until next time, stay secure.
Thank you for listening to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. Until next time, stay secure, and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast.